anxious that no opportunity of collecting useful information during the voyage should be lost, I proposed to the hydrographer, Captain Francis Beaufort, that some well-educated and scientific person should be sought for who would willingly share such accommodations as I had to offer, in order to profit by the opportunity of visiting distant countries yet little known. Captain Beaufort approved of the suggestion and wrote to Professor Peacock of Cambridge, who consulted with a friend, Professor Henslow, and he named Mr. Charles Darwin, grandson of Dr. Darwin, the poet, as a young man of promising ability, extremely fond of geology, and indeed all branches of natural history. So wrote Captain Robert Fitzroy of the HMS Beagle in his account of a now famous voyage to South America in 1831. In addition to his famous plant and animal observations, did the 22-year-old Charles Darwin make discoveries of equal importance to geologists? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How was a young landlubber, slated to become a rural clergyman, selected to be the scientist aboard the Beagle? What opposition did he have to overcome? And what was the British Navy doing way over in the Pacific in the first place? Our guests are Robert Dott and Charles Byers, Emeritus Professors of Sedimentary Geology at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We think of Darwin with Origin of Species, evolution, and so on. We don't really think that much about this early time of his life. What got you interested in sort of the early Charles Darwin?
Well, I'll speak first to that. I'm Bob Dott, and in 1960 and 61, I first got involved in doing research in the Southern Hemisphere, primarily in the Antarctic Peninsula south of South America, and then later did a lot more work in Southern South America, Patagonia and Tierra del Fuego especially. And one could hardly help but become interested in Darwin's accounts of his voyage on the Beagle through the Tierra del Fuego region. And after just a few trips there, I realized I was sort of following in his footsteps. He would refer to specific locations where we would go to work. So over time, I became more and more interested in him. And a colleague who's now at the University of Texas and I were collaborating in quite a bit of our work in that region. And the two of us both became fascinated with following Darwin's footsteps. And we presented a talk at a meeting just 2 years ago about following in Darwin's footsteps, in Tierra del Fuego especially. And we decided maybe we should expand that short talk we'd given into an article. And so he and I have been working on that since.
Was it relatively easy to follow Darwin's footsteps if we're talking the passage of so many years now?
Yes, it is. Not for the least reason being that Captain Fitzroy named many geographic features which appear now in the modern maps. And so when they talk about a certain fjord or a glacier or a mountain, we can pinpoint that pretty accurately. Some of them not so. That was very interesting. I want to read a quotation from his autobiography of how important the voyage of the Beagle was to him. Quote, "The voyage of the Beagle has been by far the most important event in my life and has determined my whole career. Yet it depended on so small a circumstance as my uncle offering to drive me 30 miles to Shrewsbury in order to persuade my father to let me go. I've always felt that I owe to the voyage the first real training or education of my mind."
Well, and that brings up his sort of family situation. And maybe before we get him on board the Beagle for that journey, we should get him born. Can you tell us something about the birth of Charles Darwin and the significance of the particular family that he was part of?
I'm Charlie Byers. My interest in Darwin partly arises from conversations with my colleague Bob. But beyond that, for many years I've taught a course at the UW called Evolution and Extinction. And you can't teach about evolution without learning something about Darwin. And so what I will say in the next few minutes really derives from my classes and the things that I thought would interest 18-year-olds here at the UW. You see pictures of Darwin, he's got that bald head and that great big beard, but he was 22 years old when he got on the ship, and he was a kid. And he managed, as Bob just said, to get there by a series of accidents. It wasn't planned at all. He was the fifth child out of six, born to his father, who was a doctor, and his mother, who was from the Wedgwood family. Dr. Darwin was practicing in Shrewsbury in Western England. And in addition to being a successful physician, he made enough money via his investments to provide a very comfortable life for Charles and his siblings. In fact, it's been estimated that Dr. Darwin's medical fees only accounted for about a third of his total income in a given year. Not only did he invest in shares and in land, he lent money to his impoverished neighbors among the aristocracy, and he wrote mortgages on their property. When he died in the middle of the 19th century, he had an estate of £250,000. If you multiply that by a factor of 50 or so, you'll see that he was, by our standards, a very rich man.
Did he want Darwin not to become a physician?
No, he definitely wanted both his sons to become physicians, as he had been forced to become a physician because his grandfather, Charles's grandfather, Erasmus, was a physician. So it ran in the family.
Then where did this business of the clergy come in?
Well, it takes a little bit to get there. Charles was born in 1809. Tennyson and Gladstone were born in that same year. And so we're pre-Victorian, but headed that way. Both of Charles's parents were of the landed gentry. They were not aristocracy, but they were rich for their time. And Charles was brought up in a very fancy house that the doctor had constructed called the Mount in the countryside near Shrewsbury. And it was there that Charles lived until he went away to Edinburgh to medical college when he was 16.
And he lost his mother early, didn't he?
He lost his mother when he was 8 years old. And his upbringing was then taken over by his three older sisters and his older brother, also named Erasmus, who was 5 years older than he was. All accounts of Darwin's childhood show him to be a kind of dreamy, introspective child, being coddled by his family, enjoying life amongst the servants there on the Mount, and spending lots and lots of his time collecting everything he could get his hands on, shells, rocks, fossils, feathers, birds, and once he got old enough, shooting partridges, shooting pheasants, shooting rabbits.
Was he lining up the bodies categorizing them?
And eventually, he actually learned to stuff the animals. And so he was a real taxidermist.
So did he come by all of that, though, this interest in collecting things? Did he come by that sort of on his own? Or
it seems
so
as if
that was the nature of young
right,
Darwin.
That was him. And then overlaid on top of that was this kind of rich kid life that he was able to pursue. He never had to think about money at all, and never did until he was a medical student, actually.
I've got this quote from his father saying, "You care for nothing but shooting dogs and rat catching, and you will be a disgrace to yourself and all your family."
Absolutely. And this was when he had decided, finally told his dad, "No, I'm not going to be a doctor," after 2 years at Edinburgh.
He was gassed at blood.
Yes.
Was that really?
Yes.
Yeah.
And his father was, too. His father was a very successful physician, apparently a good psychologist. He had a wonderful bedside manner. He was able to convince his patients that he knew what was best for them. He was a very forcible man. And so he was able to maintain his practice for many decades there in Shrewsbury. And got Charles going even before he went to medical school, starting to help him with his patient load.
So where would young Darwin go if he's not going to medical school? He's invested 2 years of his life in this, and this
right.
isn't what
and
he wants
hates,
to do. Did he know what he wanted?
Every minute of it.
Did he know what he wanted to do instead?
No.
What he wanted to do was to mess around with shooting, wandering the countryside, playing with dogs.
Not acceptable
so
to be just a gentleman?
Not enough for the doctor. Dr. Darwin was a very straight-laced man.
Didn't
drink at all, was suspicious of this kind of card-playing existence that we've seen. You see all that in the Victorian novels of young gentlemen who are out playing all the time. And Dr. Darwin was terrified that Charles was going to turn into one of those guys.
What about the spiritual side in the home? Was Darwin raised within the Church of England?
His mother was a Unitarian, and took the kids to the Unitarian Chapel while she was alive. Dr. Darwin had been a Unitarian but shifted more toward the Church of England, and the kids were all confirmed in the Church of England. So that by the time Charles was a teenager and his mother was gone, he was conventionally religious in a Church of England fashion. But the idea that he would become a clergyman had nothing to do with any religious predisposition.
It was just an income.
It was just going to be a career choice.
And his father approved of that?
His father,
I think reluctantly,
figured that was there weren't very many other choices. He was not cut out to be a soldier or a politician, and he had already decided against the law and failed out of medicine.
So he could be a collector of wayward souls.
Right.
I have this quote from Darwin. My father perceived that I did not like the thought of being a physician, so he proposed that I should become a clergyman. He was very properly vehement against my turning into an idle sporting man, which then seemed my probable destination. I had scruples about declaring my belief in all the dogmas of the Church of England. Considering how fiercely I have been attacked by the Orthodox, it seems ludicrous that I once intended to be a clergyman. This intention, and my father's wish, died a natural death when, on leaving Cambridge, I joined the Beagle as a naturalist.
Yep, that says it all.
But by the time he is aboard the Beagle, he also, though, I believe Fitzroy mentions his interest in geology, so where does that come in?
Well, Fitzroy, as your first quotation from Fritz mentioned about him, he was anxious that they have some kind of naturalist on board. He had two functions on the ship. One was to have dinner with Fitzroy, who needed a gentleman to eat with him. And in the British Navy in those days, you probably know, the captain could not mix, even with his crew, even with his junior officers. And so he needed someone to dine with him. That was job one. But two, Fitzroy was really quite scientifically oriented and very strong background in mathematics and so on for his navigation. He was very outstanding in his career. And so he was anxious to have somebody who would do as much natural history as possible. And so Darwin was identified as a young man with promise in that regard by his mentor at Cambridge, Henslow.
What had Darwin actually done that made him seem so promising?
Well, that was Henslow's judgment. Mm-hmm. And Henslow obviously saw in Darwin something that I don't think anyone else did. And but he'd gone on long walks with Henslow quite frequently. Henslow was primarily a botanist, and that didn't really catch particularly with Darwin. He was more interested in beetles than anything else at that time, and he collected them voraciously.
Did he have any experience, even amateur experience, though, as a geologist before stepping aboard the Beagle?
While he was at Cambridge, he was there for 3 years, and while he was there, he took a course from Professor Adam Sedgwick, who is one of the founders of modern geology. And he had had some geological training at Edinburgh while he was still a medical student, Darwin had. But his work with Sedgwick galvanized him, and Sedgwick even took him along as a field assistant in the summer before he left on the Beagle. So he had had some, they were working in Wales, and so he had had a little bit of field work under the training of one of the best geologists in the world, but a very short bit of training. It really only lasted a few weeks, and then he came back from that trip to find the letter inviting him on the voyage.
Did fossils enter into his interest in geology at all?
Somewhat, but not especially. Certainly they weren't primary.
And what was Fitzroy's interest in geology? Did it have a practical side, or was it just more intellectual?
I think it was more intellectual, and I think it was broader than just geology. It was natural history.
Things weren't quite as segregated into activities or different kinds
disciplines.
Of science mm-hmm. in those days. They really were natural historians. They had very broad interests. Even Henslow, who was a botanist.
He taught
everything. Yeah. And so Darwin would go for walks with Henslow, and they'd talk about everything.
So who was sponsoring the voyage of the Beagle then, and what was its aim?
The British Navy, essentially.
And
their main
aim
was to chart the coast of southern South America on both Atlantic Pacific sides. It was actually a second voyage for that purpose, and Fitzroy had been a junior officer in the first one. But when the captain of that vessel in the first survey committed suicide, Fitzroy was raised to the captaincy of the Beagle.
And what was Fitzroy like in small quarters over long periods of time?
As best we can judge today, he was bipolar. He was a very difficult personality at times, especially when he'd been under stress for a long time, as he was.
Constantly. Yeah.
And it made life very difficult for young Darwin.
How?
But usually Fitzroy would get over it. In fact, he'd often apologize to Darwin later.
So it would just be stormy scenes or getting angry with him? Or?
As far as I can tell, yeah. Angry and then stop speaking, things like that.
Did it take a lot of convincing of Darwin's father to get the go-ahead for this voyage of the Beagle?
Indeed.
Yeah, it definitely did.
As I mentioned in quotation I get from his autobiography, he called upon his uncle, who was very close to Uncle Wedgwood, Hosiah, Uncle Josh. And Uncle Josh finally intervened with the father. And what was it? Father said, if you find one man of good sense who will endorse this, then
and so he
did. He knew right away who to go to.
So did Father Darwin lay down any conditions for this?
Not that I'm aware
of. Not once he. Charles listened to his father's diatribe and then wrote a list of objections and carried that list to his uncle. And his uncle then wrote a letter refuting each of those and sent it back. And apparently Dr. Darwin then decided that, yes, these are logical reasons. And the reasons that he had raised were those of a dad who has paid hundreds and hundreds of dollars to send his kid to school and thinks he's almost ready to start his career. And then he comes in with a letter saying, I'm going around the world,
he's
Dad.
He's got a dropout on
years,
his hands.
I'm dropping out. And so Dr. Darwin's original list, it wasn't well thought out. He said, well, it's a wild scheme. And
the British Navy.
The British Admiralty. Yeah, it was not a wild scheme at all. And so Uncle Joe was able to say, yes, this will work, and you should let Charles go. And once Dr. Darwin approved, then he ponied up. He had to pay £600, I should say, in order to get Charles outfitted for the voyage, which is 2 years' worth of time at Cambridge in those days.
And had Charles Darwin had any experience prior to this on being on boats or...
No, not at all.
So
and
he really
was seasick all the time.
Seasick the
he
whole
never
voyage.
Got over it.
It sounds like something out of Gilbert and Sullivan, doesn't it? Never sick at sea.
Yes,
but it must have been so exciting for him to, because all the comments I've seen from Darwin suggest that he was very bored at school, very confined with
very
the sort
much.
Of traditional academic approach to learning.
Yeah, especially in his pre-college.
His time at Shrewsbury boarding school, which is just a few miles from his home, but he lived at the school. The education was entirely classical, and so he didn't like it. He just spent all his time trying to learn Greek and Latin, but all he wanted to do was get out in the natural world. And so when he finally got to Cambridge and met some professors who were interested in the natural world, and he read von Humboldt's book on travel, Charles came up with the idea of sponsoring his own trip as kind of a sightseeing trip to the tropics after he finished college. And fortuitously, the Beagle Voyage showed up, so he didn't have to run his own trip.
What do we know about his personality prior to this time? He strikes me as someone who was something of a loner.
Definitely
very
a loner.
Definitely.
He'd go for long walks by himself. Yeah. When he was with his family or his close boon companions, he was a jolly fellow. He was tall. He was athletic. He was good-looking. Didn't seem to spend much time with the opposite sex. He was engaged in all those shooting, card-playing activities. But at the same time, the shooting and card-playing guys realized that there was more to him than that and that he was actually kind of proud of his intellectual capacity and spent a lot of time reading as well.
What was he planning to do when he got back from this voyage? Was he planning to somehow systematize all this information that he presumably would be gathering? What was his plan?
Well, you mean before he left?
Mm-hmm.
When he left, he thought he was going to take up a living in the Church of England, and he'd go out and collect beetles on Sunday afternoons.
He thought he'd come back from this, what was it, like a two-year trip on
the
Beagle?
Right, it was supposed to be a two-year trip.
And just go right into the clergy, and that would be that.
He'd be then a clergyman.
Just have some good stories to tell.
It turned out to be 5 years.
Yeah. and Dr. Darwin thought of this as a two-year get-it-out-of-your-system trip. And so that was another reason he gave his blessing.
Well, we're going to sail with the young Charles Darwin aboard the Beagle in just a moment. This is University of the Year. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, Charles Byers and Robert Dott. They are geologists, and we're looking with them at the young Charles Darwin as he sails aboard the HMS Beagle on this voyage of discovery, and it, I suppose, had some practical implications, too. The British out here on the ocean, are they pretty much unopposed politically at this point? They've defeated Napoleon.
They've defeated Napoleon. It's the middle of the 1820s, and the Spanish colonies in the New World had managed to throw off the Spanish yoke to some degree. Spain didn't want to let that go, but the Brits realized that this was an opening. They could start trading with the former colonies, newly independent republics in South America. But because they hadn't been able to do that for centuries, they didn't have any good charts of South America. And this was the fundamental reason that Fitzroy's voyage was undertaken, was to prepare proper charts for trade. And to this end, Fitzroy had all kinds of navigational equipment crammed into the Beagle, chronometers and sextants and so on. And he would spend infinite amounts of time going back and forth and back and forth, charting every last little bit of the Spanish.
Well, you know, one rock can ruin the whole trip.
It can, and that's why the trip took 5 years instead of two.
How big was the Beagle?
60 feet.
60 feet?
60 feet, 190-ton displacement.
Wow. Yeah. What did Darwin do most of the time? Because, I mean, he couldn't really do much exploring until they got
Well, they'd land. They'd hit port. Darwin would leap off. He had this letter of credit from his dad. He'd go to a bank, draw funds, hire people to drive him around and guide him through the countryside, make friends with the diplomats and the English folk, if there were any around.
There were quite a few, actually.
And there were quite a few. Yeah. And meanwhile, Fitzroy would be going back and forth studying the coastline, and that was when Darwin got his geology done.
And was there communication between the people on the Beagle and then back at home? Was it known what was happening during those 5 years?
Well, I mean, everything depended on mail, which was handed from ship to ship. And so Darwin would write letters, and he wrote reports, and he sent his collections, the bones and stuff that he found. He would ship back to England with letters to his professors.
He shipped a lot of samples, thousands of rocks, minerals, and fossils, and modern organisms, birds and things. Mostly, I think, they sent them to Henslow, and he took charge of them. And he would farm out things to various experts in Britain.
Oh, so this is a bone. We send it to whatever the equivalent of a paleontologist.
Owen, in London. It was the leading vertebrate anatomist of the day. And some of these were described and published even before Darwin came home. And so a great deal of material was studied already. In fact, that was fine when he got back because he was already famous. He already had a reputation.
Or that had literally preceded him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I gather he's quite meticulous about indicating where he's found this and
I think in general you could say he was, but I remember that regarding the Galapagos Islands, the famous finches, he later realized, another ornithologist actually studied them. He really wasn't that expert in many of these fields that he later became so famous for.
So we don't see him like Audubon or somebody doing a lot of sketches of what he's seeing.
I don't think of
not
the
so much
organisms.
In not of the right. Animals and plants. I mean, he'd make detailed observations, but not so much on the drawing end of things.
Lots of notes.
And so what exactly was the route then? They sail and land where first?
Well, they first landed in Brazil, and he had a chance to have his first experience in a rainforest, which he really wanted to do. He'd been wanting to do that for years. And I don't recall how long there, but it was some weeks, and the ship was busy charting that part of the coast. And then they moved down to the La Plata estuary between Montevideo on the north and Argentina on the south. And they usually used Montevideo or Montevideo, as some people call it, for their primary base in that part of South America. I've been puzzled over that. Why weren't they using Buenos Aires, which is across the estuary? But maybe there was more politically friendly.
Yeah, different countries.
But anyway, then they'd chart in that area and move on down the coast of the Atlantic into the Pampas, famous Pampas region. And it was on the first trip down that coast, and well, back up, in the winter, they would work in these more northerly areas of northern Argentina and Montevideo and so forth. And then in the summer, they would go on to the south, down into southern Patagonia and Tierra del Fuego. Well, first time along that Pampas coast, he landed and went to a place called Punta Alta, High Point, basically, and discovered these mammal bones, big ones, and realized they were fossil. And he wasn't a great anatomist, at least not yet, but he knew they were old and they were different. And he collected a lot of those. And those were sent back to Owen in London, and they created quite a stir because these were fossil mammals that no one had seen before in many cases.
And what were they
big,
then?
Big giant land sloths, for example. A giant guanaco or guanaco relative. Guanaco is a cameloid that's similar to llamas and
alpacas.
Alpaca, yes. Thank you. Yeah. And there were a number of others. They're less well known to people, glyptodons and the like.
Was Darwin hardy? I know he had been seasick on the way over, but once he got on land,
he was very hardy. He was vigorous and very adventuresome, because another thing he did in the Pampas was to tie himself to parties of
the gauchos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he would spend not just days but weeks on one tour, clear across the Pampas and back up to Buenos Aires. And he lived with them. He slept on the ground, ate their broiled half a calf or half a cow. And he did the same again up in Uruguay to the north two different times.
Were these just geological expeditions at this point?
Primarily, yes.
Any evidence?
He would also note the biota, too, I mean, living plants and animals, but mostly geological.
Any evidence in the sort of his early notes that he's starting to question, you know, the age of the earth, the sort of what would later become origin of species kinds of ideas?
There are just a few. In my readings of him, I've only seen a very few references, the most interesting of which is in a visit to the Falkland Islands, which was, of course, British protectorate, so to speak, and it made two visits there. And first thing he found was fossils in the rocks, which he recognized were similar to such fossils back in Britain. And so, in effect, he made geologic dating of these for the first time. But in one place, he talks about the cattle that were being raised on these islands. They're two major islands separated by a strait. So they're essentially isolated, certainly for cattle. And they'd been introduced by Argentine ranchers quite a long time before the Beagle. I'm sorry, I don't know just how long. So they'd been isolated on these two islands, and from them each other and from the mainland. And he noticed that they were somewhat different in their markings, especially between the two islands.
In their markings.
And thus isolation has somehow produced the differences in these animals. I thought that was really interesting. He doesn't carry it anywhere that I know.
Really? That doesn't come out in the Galapagos at all when he gets up that way?
There's a distinction, I think, that needs to be drawn between the concept of the great age of the earth and organic evolution. The geologists by this time, the time of the Beagle, had come to the conclusion that the earth was very much longer than the few thousand years certified in Genesis. And Charles Lyell, who was the most eminent geologist, British geologist of the time, had written his book, The Principles of Geology, and Darwin had that book with him on board the Beagle. And so he looked at the South American landscape and then the landscape around the rest of the world through Lyellian eyes, more or less, and came to the idea that Lyell was probably right, that slow, gradual change could affect big geological results. So he wasn't necessarily thinking much about evolution by this point, but he was certainly thinking of an old Earth.
Mm-hmm. Lyell's book became his Bible for geology. He really learned his geology from Lyell on the voyage.
Does he make any observations about humans at this point and similarities or differences among populations of humans as he travels these vast distances?
Some, yes. He noticed in Tierra del Fuego, he noticed that the Puegan Indians there were smaller than those in southern Patagonia. The southern Patagonian Indians are quite tall, large feet, which is what their name means, what Patagonia means, big feet. So he did recognize that difference. He didn't draw implications
from it?
Not really.
But what about politically? Did he ever sort of come into contact with, you know, the whole notion of imperialism and native peoples and... Or did he just sort of keep collecting fossils and sort of stay clear of all that?
I have the impression that Darwin wasn't so much confronted with that. I mean, the word imperialism that we have now is so different from what people were thinking in those days. But it's certainly the case that Fitzroy had that scheme to civilize the Fuegans.
Oh, yes.
And I think Darwin was kind of appalled at that, which ended badly. And Darwin certainly didn't follow Fitzroy down this kind of sociological experiment that he was going to try and do with the Fuegan people.
To bring Fuegans back to England.
From the first voyage,
he brought four back and was going to civilize them and then take them back, and they would civilize their brethren.
A missionary approach.
Mm-hmm. One of them died early, and so there were only three that he brought back on the second voyage to one of the larger Fuegian settlements, not very far from Cape Horn, actually. Well, they stayed there for a couple of days, and there was a very young, very naive British would-be pastor with them, and he was going to help teach them religion and all. And they planted gardens for them in British style and so on. Well, then Fitzroy and the Beagle went away to do some surveying and came back about a month later. And predictably, I'd say, the local Fuegians had stripped practically all the clothes off these hapless three, and they'd torn up the garden, and the young minister-to-be was just, he was beside himself. And Fitzroy said, we better take you with us. So they did.
How was the map-making going at this point? They've trekked from the eastern point of Brazil all the way down to Cape Horn.
Yes.
That's a lot of charting.
It is. But this, of course, is the total. I figured out the total time spent in Tierra del Fuego was about a year.
Really?
Yeah,
you know,
two different seasons, different summer seasons, yeah. About a year, yeah. And so Darwin got to see a great deal down there in a year. And he kept going back and forth. So he revisited several places and was able to comment and make more observations.
Did he run into danger? Either, from people or from the extreme weather or?
Yes, various kinds of danger always down there. And some trouble with Fuegians. The Fuegians sometimes would attack their camps, and they had to hold them off with guns and frighten them and so on. They didn't shoot any. They didn't kill any, thank goodness.
Did he make observations of glaciers when he was down
he
that
did.
Way?
And I might read a passage from one of his endeavors at a glacier. Well, first, though, let me read this about the Fuegians. I could not have believed how wide was the difference between savage and civilized man. It is greater than between wild and domesticated animals. These Fuegians are miserable wretches. Their only garment consists of a mantle made of guanaco skin with the wool outside. This they wear just thrown over their shoulders, leaving their persons as often exposed as covered. They subsist upon fish, shellfish, seals, birds, eggs, and the putrid blubber of beached whale carcasses.
Yeah, well, okay, does he have a sense here that that's what works for them? That's their adaptation? In their way they're thriving better than they would if they were loaded with, corsets and collars?
I don't recall any extensive discussion
of that. What does he call them, miserable wretches or
yes,
something? Yes. I mean, it doesn't sound as if he sees much in the way of redeeming.
He couldn't see anything redeeming as far as I can tell.
With the glaciers, what is it that he sees?
Well, the glacier, yes. They landed early in the surveying in the southernmost part of Tierra del Fuego along the Beagle Channel, incidentally, which was named by Fitzroy on a previous voyage. At last, down came a mass of roaring noise, and immediately we noticed the smooth outline of a wave traveling toward us. This is a calving glacier, and they're right up near the snout. The men ran down as quickly as they could to the boats, for the chance of their being dashed to pieces was evident. These are smaller boats now. They left the Beagle way out at the east end of the Beagle Channel, I think for safety as much as anything, because they hadn't charted this very much yet. And they used the smaller boats for the actual in-close charting. One of the seamen just caught hold of the bows as the curling breaker reached it. He was knocked over and over, but not hurt. This was most fortunate for us, for we were 100 miles distant from the Beagle, and we would have been left without provisions or firearms. So that was a very tense moment. And apparently, he didn't say it himself, but Darwin apparently helped rescue the boat and so on. And for that, Fitzroy named mountain after him.
Well, there are plenty of mountains to go around, I guess.
Yeah.
Any experiences with other geological phenomena, or volcanoes or earthquakes?
Yes. Can I postpone that? Let me tell you, read Cape Horn. Cape Horn demanded his tribute, and before night sent us a gale of wind directly in our teeth. We stood out to sea, and on the second day again made the land, when we saw on our weather bow this notorious promontory in its proper form, veiled in mist and its dim outlines surrounded by a storm of wind and water. The captain determined to run into Wigwam Cove. This is a snug harbor not far from Cape Horn, and here we at Christmas Eve anchored in smooth water. And I can vouch for that description of Cape Horn. It's a very, very
well, how nice that Darwin wrote so much, you know, because he's got good notes and he writes well.
He had these elaborate diaries.
Yeah.
And, you know, fairly early in the voyage, before they even got to South America, he had resolved that he would write a book about it. And he was anxious to write a book, you know, and he was anxious to travel. Those two things were really...
Cape Horn was still the way to go, too. You wouldn't even traditionally or routinely go through the Strait of Magellan, would you, because it was just too rough?
I think it was mainly because it wasn't charted well enough. It's actually an easy trip through now, and it's protected because it's inland water. Cape Horn is a horror. I can vouch for it.
You said, Charlie, that you teach Darwin to young college students.
Yes.
I'm assuming that the one thing that would appeal to them is just this idea of leaving home, going on an adventure. What are some of the things about the parts we've been talking about that you find your students particularly like to hear about?
I think they're interested in the idea of getting away from home, which is what Charles did. And whether there's some, the kids today are so interested in the natural history as Charles was, I'm not sure that's the case. I think kids today would probably be much more interested in the culture of the folks, the Fuegans and so on, maybe the political and moral questions rather than the straightforward natural history, which captivated Charles and captivated you. I mean, you've spent a lot of time down there.
Yeah. Yes.
We're going to have some final thoughts on the voyage of young Darwin when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Charles Darwin is the Abraham of scientific men, a searcher as obedient to the command of truth as was the patriarch to the command of God. That's a comment by John Tyndall in Science and Man. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our two guests are Charlie Byers and Bob Dott, and we are talking about young Darwin in southern South America. We've got him collecting things, sending back bones and rocks to England for analysis. What about the whole sort of topography of the region? What does he add? You're both geologists. I'm just thinking, what does Darwin come up with?
Well,
I've never been there, so I'm deferring completely to Bob in this instance.
The topography of Tierra del Fuego is very rugged, and a lot of large ice caps and smaller glaciers, and they've carved fjords through the region. In the past, of course, during the famous Ice Age, there was even more ice. Almost everything, all the fjords and so were practically full to the brim with ice. So we're seeing something sort of in the transition of melting. Tierra del Fuego is essentially the southernmost tip of the Andean or Andes mountain system, which extends all the way up to Central America. And it, too, is very high and rugged and deeply carved valleys and so forth with ice caps of considerable size in the highest parts of it. Patagonia is mostly a plain out east of the mountains and north, like our Great Plains, the west, east of the Rocky Mountains. It's a similar, very similar relationship topographically. The climate in the south is very humid, humid temperate climate. At sea level, there's relatively little snow, only lasts for days, but higher elevations, of course, it lasts and forms the glaciers. But there's a temperate rainforest covering most of the south of a species of beech tree, several species, three actually. And their counterparts are found today in a few other parts of the southern hemisphere in similar settings. For example, in places like New Zealand, some of the islands north. And the fossil record of those is still more widespread, so that almost all of the southernmost parts of the southern continents have fossils of these trees. And that speaks to a different geologic issue of continental drift. But, of course, that's not relevant for Darwin.
It's ahead of his time.
Century later.
Yeah.
When they finally finished in Tierra del Fuego and started north, they went through the Straits of Magellan into the Pacific Ocean and then charted up the west coast of southern Chile, which is also rainforest country. And he would go ashore whenever he possibly could, as we've seen already, partly to get away from seasickness, but also to see whatever he could in terms of natural history. And as they moved farther north, it came into a region, and he witnessed some volcanic eruptions. He wasn't very close. He wasn't in danger. He wasn't at the tip of a lava flow, but he nonetheless could see this spectacular show on the horizon. And then shortly after that, about halfway up the Chilean Pacific coast, one day they were suddenly shaken by a very severe earthquake, probably an 8 or 9 on the Richter scale of today. And he has a rather vivid description of that. And then I'll come back to the read part of that description. But then a little later, he had the opportunity to go into the Andes Mountains, into the heart of the Andes Mountains on the border between Chile and Argentina, and spent several days in a long traverse. And then it later made another shorter traverse into the northernmost Chilean Andes. So he got to see these mountains. They were very high, they're rugged. He collected from the rocks, noticed that there were marine fossils in them that he recognized as belonging to what was then called the secondary era of geologic time.
So there's some kind of upheaval obviously happening.
Yes, exactly. That's the point. He said, first of all, these are marine fossils. They're in obviously very thick strata. So that means the crust of the earth in this region had first subsided to great depths and then obviously been uplifted. And he had observed another interesting thing. On the Atlantic coast of Patagonia, there's a whole series of stair-step notches, so to speak, like a flight of stairs. And these had marine shoreline fossils in each of them. And he said, those must have been shoreline positions successively that have been raised. So the crust had raised again. And then on the Pacific coast in western Chile, he found some similar terraces, we call them, ancient shorelines. And from that, he concluded that, up and down of the crust is very important. And, of course, then he connected the earthquake because he experienced, and all the people on the ship, experienced an uplift of several meters, different amounts in different places. And he thought, if we had a whole lot of earthquakes, this is thinking like Lyle now, if we have many earthquakes over time, incrementally, maybe that could raise a mountain range, the Andes. And incidentally, that speculation on his part had a great influence on Lyle himself, whom he later met when he came back to England. They were good friends for the rest of his life. Well, let me read this about the earthquakes and mountain building. The earth, the very emblem of all that is solid, had moved beneath our feet like a crust over a fluid. 1 second of time has created in the mind a strange idea of insecurity, which hours of reflection would not have produced. And then on mountain making. Who can avoid wondering at the force which has upheaved these mountains, and even more so at the countless ages which it must have required to have broken through, removed, and leveled a whole mass of them by erosion? And he recognized that a great deal of the mountains that doesn't exist has been eroded off and dumped out on the Patagonian plains. A vast lake of melted matter of an area double the extent of the Black Sea is spread out beneath a mere crust of solid land. Nothing, not even the wind that blows, is so unstable as the level of the crust of the earth. How about that?
I suppose it's good training for Darwin to be looking at all the different features, you know, the rock, the weather, the plants, little animals.
Absolutely.
Like, I mean, sort of to get the sort of what we would consider ecology, the whole picture.
Uh-huh.
Any mistaken impressions or surmises on his part?
Oh, yes. One major one. And he was following Lyle, having read his book. There were strange boulders scattered around the southern part of Tierra del Fuego and a little bit of southernmost Patagonia. He puzzled over these. And they were similar to boulders found in northern Europe, including his own home country, scattered around. They're erratic boulders. Most all of us here in Wisconsin are familiar with erratic boulders, having been dropped by the Great Continental Glacier. Well, he failed to see that, and so did Lyle, although other people postulated that at the time. But Lyle envisioned that they were transported by floating ice, icebergs, and then dropped helter-skelter. In other words, you had to have the crust subside to drown an area.
Right.
Icebergs float in, get stranded as the crust rises again.
It's a little more complicated, isn't it?
Yeah. So, but that was, both of them adhered to that years and years and years. And that was their biggest mistake.
So as the voyage of the Beagle ends and they go back to England, they're already sort of famous for having discovered. Is it mostly Darwin that's famous, or is Fitzroy also?
No, Darwin.
Just Darwin, because he's sending the notes and the specimens?
Right. Fitzroy was too busy charting.
Was Fitzroy ever envious of Darwin, or was it a good relationship?
Well, it was pretty good, except for these ups and downs, these outbursts of his polar. He actually was going to resign his commission in Valparaiso, Chile, because he had a nervous breakdown, very straightforward. And he actually turned the command over to first lieutenant. But the lieutenant said, no, don't do that. And Darwin actually helped reason with him. And he got better slowly, and finally he took over the rest of the voyage. So that was very difficult. Now, when they came back, I think they were probably still pretty good friends. But when Darwin saw fit to publish The Voyage of the Beagle as a popular book, first it was part of a large multi-volume report of the whole expedition.
A common procedure back then. Yeah.
But Darwin saw fit to publish it separately, and it was an immediate success. And Fitzroy was pretty put off by that.
Mm-hmm.
And then also by then, differences of religious ideas had become pretty serious between them.
They'd about have to, wouldn't
Prince
they?
Prince Fitzroy was very, very conventional, and he could see this young man was way off on the wrong track.
What about the father? Did he, you know, obviously the clergyman thing's not working out and the voyage is taking a different direction, but as he's seeing the publication, the fame, is he happy?
He's happy. I think he was happy that Charles had found a niche for himself. And it was clear by the time Charles returned that Charles's work, which had already been published, was being lauded in the scientific establishment. And Dr. Darwin was enough of a realist to understand that his son, in fact, was carving out a new career. And he acquiesced completely in the idea that Charles would not take up a religious living. The idea of the religious living wasn't at bottom a religious idea at all. It was a career idea. And since Charles had made an alternative career and done it very well, the doctor was completely happy about it, as were the rest of his family, as was his cousin Emma, whom he married soon after he returned from the Beagle voyage. So he was a successful man in a scientific sense. He had all the money he would ever need. He had a rich wife and was able to settle down and start working, writing his Beagle book soon after he returned.
Yeah. Well, 28 years separate the Voyage of the Beagle and the Origin of the Species.
Yeah.
What's the connection between the two?
Well, he published several more volumes in geology. They're a little more technical, not for the layman, within the years after. And I'd like to emphasize that his first 20 years of his career were in geology, primarily. He collected these other organic things, modern and ancient, but really his main contributions scientifically were geology, which most people don't realize. So we have to push that.
And do you think they were important to the later Darwin?
They were. His notion of uplift incrementally with earthquakes, that had quite an impact, especially with Lyell, but through him then it was perpetuated more broadly. And of course his contributions on fossils, as is slightly distinct from evolution, were very important because he discovered all these new things no one knew about.
Does he ever refer in The Origin of Species directly to his experiences aboard the Beagle?
You know, I don't recall.
Not so much.
No.
Most of, you know, The Origin is there's a lot of material on modern-day animals and plants and breeding experiments and all the pigeon stuff and so on and so on and so on.
Earthworms.
It's not so much a geological book,
right?
By comparison with all this geology that he had already done. And he was a member of the Geological Society. In fact, he was an officer in the Geological Society, which is the first one in the world, the one in Britain.
And that was very soon after the Beagle voyage, almost immediately.
He was a well-respected scientist immediately upon return.
Well, when does the worm, so to speak, start to turn for Darwin, from rocks to animals and plants?
Well, during the later, it's mostly in the late 1830s.
Yes.
He starts privately making notes. There's this famous notebook he starts writing on the species issue. But he kept it private for so long, even from
yes.
Lyell.
It's within a couple of years after his return from the voyage. He's thinking about all this stuff and making notes to himself and has it in mind that this will be a long-term project, which, in fact, it was.
But I gather it was sort of speeded in its culmination by rumors of competition?
Yes, very definitely. Yeah.
And do you think the early voyage with sort of seeing all these different environments, changing landscapes, different animals in different places, how important do you think that was for what would turn into the Darwin that becomes much more famous?
I'm glad you asked that because I wanted to be sure to emphasize that this voyage around the world from arid regions to humid regions, from north to south, was an incredible opportunity for a bright, young, observant fellow like him. And hardly anyone else had ever had such an experience. There were a few other naturalists of his era. Some went on voyages around the world, but they didn't see much, apparently. I've heard of one case like that. But certainly he absorbed it like a sponge, and it played a huge role, I think.
Yeah.
Just imagine seeing all these different environments and different living animals and plants even.
You'd have to think about adaptation, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you have to. Absolutely. Yeah.
And even if he says in the autobiography, I started the voyage a complete believer in the words of Genesis that the special creation had occurred, but then the evidence piled in on him over those next few years. And so his eyes opened a little bit, mm-hmm. and then he started thinking about this in a scientific sense.
Our guests have been Charles Byers and Robert Dott. A pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Our pleasure.
Hurry back. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4, psychiatrist Ron Diamond will be our guest, and he'll give us some insights into schizophrenia. Join us for University of the Air next Sunday afternoon and each Sunday afternoon at 4, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.